It's almost impossible to classify these things as mistakes or errors because it's based on the best scientific knowledge of the time. This is a rapidly changing field. In a year, we may know something different. In 5 years, we may know something different.
Welcome to Genotypecast, a new podcast from Gray Genetics. Genetics isn't always black and white. News stories related to genetics often raise more questions than they answer. On Genotypecast, we bring you insight from genetic counselors. I'm your host, Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service.
You know, there are numbers and numbers of these cases. Not all of them make the news.
The Wall Street Journal recently profiled a family whose BRCA2 variant was reclassified from pathogenic to a variant of uncertain significance. This difference in classification has important implications for medical management recommendations. The family profiled, however, made irreversible decisions years ago based on the pathogenic classification provided at the time. Ann Jeffress Brown is a certified genetic counselor and has a total of 15 years experience in both clinic and industry with a focus on hereditary cancer. Ann is currently living in Colorado and works for Myriad Genetics. Ann, thank you so much for coming on Genotypecast and talking to me about this article.
You are most welcome, Eleanor. It's my pleasure.
So the article that we're talking about was published in the Wall Street Journal back in December already, actually. And the title was, "A Genetic Test Led 7 Women in One Family to Have Major Surgery, Then the Odds Changed." And I know you're not a Twitter person, but on Twitter, you know, it was interesting to see just like a lot of talk around this case that really underscored that people don't really understand the probabilistic nature of classifications and the idea that these interpretations are subject to change.
I would make a disclosure right at the beginning that I am an employee of Myriad Genetics. All I know about this case is what I read in the newspaper, and even if I did have more information, I would not be able to speak about this particular case in detail as regards those specific unfortunate women who had this experience.
Right.
But I think you're right to talk about the fact that, to make it more general and to talk about variant classification in DNA testing as being probabilistic, being open to interpretation and to constantly changing. So I think that's, you know, would be a good place for us to start.
Yeah. And so I think a lot of the time, the impression that people have who don't work in genetics is that you do a genetic test and it's either positive or negative, right?
Correct.
You either have a BRCA mutation or you don't have a BRCA mutation. How is it more complicated than that?
Well, I think you're right to use the BRCA 1 and 2 genes as a model. So let's just start there. Anyone having a genetic test can get one of three different results: a positive, a negative, or an uncertain result. And obviously, getting an uncertain result means that the lab doesn't know. There is not enough evidence to say, does this increase cancer risk in this patient? So BRCA testing began in the mid-90s. The genes were identified in the mid-90s, and I think commercial testing began around 97, 96, 97. I'm not totally clear on that. But So at that point, the percentage of results on BRCA tests that came back as uncertain was somewhere around 13 to 15%.
Which at this point is a rate that would deter doctors from ordering testing at all.
Exactly. Now that rate, at least from what I know about the lab I work in, the rate for VUSs in those two genes combined is under 2%. So it still happens. It's 98% of the time it does not happen, but it still does happen. Then, when someone gets a VUS, meaning we found you know, a single nucleotide change in a gene, we can't tell you whether it increases your risk or not. At that point, what's supposed to happen is that the physician goes back to the patient's history, family history, personal history, and has a discussion with the patient about how they might or might not be at higher risk and how they want to deal with that. At that point, the genetic result is just moot. It's just as though you didn't have the test, because clinical uncertainty means clinical uncertainty. We can't tell you what to do based on this result.
And I think a lot of labs, including Myriad, or the last I knew, will report out of the U.S. with like under a headline of negative. I have seen, you know, sometimes a lab will call it positive and then say it's the U.S., will call it negative and then say of the U.S., and maybe some don't frame it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea behind that negative framing is it's not considered something actionable, where we don't have enough evidence to say, yes, this helps explain what's going on in your family, and surgical decisions, for instance, should not be made based on the finding of the U.S. Is that
exactly
right?
Exactly. Now, in this particular case, just the outlines of it, what happened is apparently there was a variant in the BRCA2 gene that Myriad and other labs were calling as positive, a deleterious mutation. If you inherit this, we are saying that you probably have very elevated risks for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And what has happened in this is a very rare variant. These cases where something is called positive and then reclassified to uncertain are very rare. They're far less than 1% of all genetic tests.
So this experience that the family had is already quite unique. It's not something that we see happen often.
It's very unique. It's horrible. My heart goes out to women, the women who've undergone these serious surgeries and now understand that they may or may not have made the right choice. Their physicians may or may not, and the lab may or may not have given them the correct guidance. However, other labs are still, I know, calling this a positive result. This kind of gets us into how variants are classified.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, testing for these genes began in the mid-1990s. And at that point, we didn't have a lot of data of these families. This was new testing. We didn't have long-term data on what happens to people when they get this result or that result. So classification was based on trying to figure out, what is this change in the gene? How does it affect the translation into protein? And sometimes it could be that studies were done in yeast. Sometimes the studies were done in other animals. Sometimes the classification would be based on, let's look at this particular region in the gene and compare it across species. And if this particular place in the gene, this particular bit of spelling in this gene, has remained the same from E. coli all the way through mammals and humans, then that probably indicates it's a very important place in the gene and changing it would have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as time went on, we not only gained a lot of data on the clinical ramifications in humans of these various changes, but understood a lot more about how to image the structure of the actual protein. Just because something is changed, just because something is conserved, does not mean that it appears in the same place in the same way in the protein, because in different species, the proteins can fold differently. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of, there was always a lot of judgment and lack of precision in classifying some variants.
Right.
As time has gone on, now at this point, I know Myriad has done over 2 million genetic tests. So now there is a lot of clinical data that says, oh, okay, let's look at these families. What is actually happening in these families who have these variants? So I'd like to quote a very accomplished biochemist I know who has a specialty in this area. Her name is Dr. Julie Eggington, and she used to tell us, the question is not, does this change in the gene affect the protein as it's made in E. coli, or in yeast, or, you know, what does it do? Ultimately, what does this change do to the protein? The question is, does it cause cancer in humans?
Mm-hmm.
So at a certain point, again, I'm just speaking for what I know about Myriad. I don't really know how other labs do their classifications in detail. But at a certain point, Myriad added a clinical component to the way they classify variants and developed an algorithm that looks at family histories across the board in patients who do have increased risk for cancer and don't have increased risk for cancer. And, you know, models these variants on that basis, as well as considering what does it do to the protein? What do we know? What does the literature say about it for the last 20 years? We now have this additional piece that gets stronger and stronger as more and more people are tested.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that when this particular variant was reclassified as perhaps uncertain, no longer clearly positive, it was based on that kind of data. It was based on clinical data that says, gosh, you know, now we've seen this occur in a number of families, and the histories per our algorithm don't look high risk.
Right. Probably either there's in the other families where Myriad has seen that variant, either there's not a striking history of cancer consistent with BRCA2 related cancer risk, or there are other variants found that are,
yes,
more compelling explanations, which then gives evidence that this is less likely to actually be a true cause of increased cancer risk.
Yes, something like that. And I am not a biochemist. I don't know, and even if I did know, couldn't go into, you know, the details behind this particular variant. But this is not an uncommon situation for a variant to be reclassified. Usually, if a variant is reclassified, it's reclassified downwards. In other words, if it's a VUS, the majority, if they are reclassified as benign.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a rare event when a variant actually gets classified, was classified as positive, and then is classified back down again. You know, there are numbers and numbers of these cases. Not all of them make the news. The other one that people may have heard about is a sort of almost a reverse situation for a family who had a child with a seizure disorder. And there are different treatments and different types of seizure disorders. This patient was tested, given a genetic test based on that. A VUS, an uncertain result, was found in a specific gene. The doctors treating the child, therefore, did not, they treated him for the more likely, more common situation, rather than this rare situation in which he had this variant in a VUS in a gene. Unfortunately, the child died, and later the lab reclassified this variant as positive, as causing this very rare syndrome. So, you know, again, a horrible, a very unfortunate situation, but it's almost impossible to classify these things as mistakes or errors, because it's based on the best scientific knowledge of the time.
Right.
And I would say that almost all of medicine is based on, at some point, based on clinical judgment, based on doctors' understandings, based on test results, the best tests we have at this moment to find, you know, to try and figure out diagnoses, et cetera, and to predict, in the case of BRCA1 and 2, to predict people's risks for disease. But unfortunately, it's, you know, it's, as you say, genetics is not black and white.
Right.
Just a little plug there for great genetics. But
Not that straightforward. That's why our profession exists.
Exactly. And I think that I would hope that this family had that kind of counseling. I know that when I was in clinical practice, I would always caution that this is what we know now. This is a rapidly changing field. In a year, we may know something different. In 5 years, we may know something different. And you and I have seen that. In the field of hereditary cancer, we've seen just numbers of new genes being identified and you know, further refinement of risk estimates based on genes, based on, and we don't yet understand well some things like, you know, I'm thinking of, in the case of Lynch syndrome, this discovery that there was actually a gene upstream of one of the Lynch syndrome genes, and changes in that gene could epigenetically silence one of the Lynch syndrome's genes, causing Lynch syndrome, even though the patient does not have a mutation in that specific gene. And we don't begin to understand all those situations. We don't understand epigenetics in general, meaning how the function of genes are changed by environmental factors, developmental factors, anything like that. So, you know, it's a tough situation in these rare families where, unfortunately, the decision goes one way or another and turns out not to have been perhaps the most, you know, absolutely correct. It's just, it's not always possible to say that, right, to say that this classification is correct. It's a moving target.
Yeah. I was surprised. Headlines have to be dramatic. Like, you know, newspapers need to have a dramatic headline to get clicks, to make any money at all, to stay in business. So I'm never surprised by a dramatic headline related to genetics. And, you know, I thought the article was fine, but I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more attention to the fact that, you know, most other labs, I think at this point, are still calling this, you know, a positive. They would say, like, this is a pathogenic variant or otherwise likely pathogenic. And like, given that, it seems like from a non-married perspective, like sort of a dramatic take to say, like, that the family made the wrong decisions or had inappropriate surgeries, because there's lots of other labs that with like the data that they have, like they would say, like, no, you probably did make the best decisions, not only with the data that you had at the time, but they would still report things out in the same way.
That's a very important point. There are certain variants on which labs disagree. And if depending on where you have your testing, you may get different results. And, you know, I don't know the insides on of other labs on what this variant is called, but that's my understanding too, that if you go into the online databases, that most of them still call this a positive result, and would a physician receiving that report then would say, yes, here are the guidelines that say if you're at this risk, your options are to do increased surveillance or to have preventive surgeries.
Right. And to test family members for this.
Exactly.
And then the same applying to them. Right.
Exactly.
And I think one thing that doesn't come up too much in genetics and should come up more is just the question of how much confidence is behind a classification. And that's something that Julie Eggington, I know she's still working on in her new company. We'll tag her on Twitter and give her a shout out. But
yes, she is the CEO, founder and CEO of the Center for Genomic Interpretation, which is a nonprofit organization that is working on this problem specifically.
Yeah, I know a recent tweet I saw was like a physician who wrote, heard an excellent and rather horrifying presentation yesterday by Dr. Eggington on widespread errors and ambiguities in clinical molecular genetic testing, even from good reputable labs. And now I don't think I'll ever be able to fully trust an NGS report again.
Oh. Well, most of the time I would trust it, but I think the doctor has a point. In some instances, there certainly is still that uncertainty, and room for judgment, and room for different entities to decide that a specific genetic change has a different meaning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me about this article and about variant classification.
Oh, you are most welcome, Eleanor. Thank you. And I'd be happy to talk with you more offline because it's such a huge subject. We've just barely scratched the surface.
If you are a certified genetic counselor and would like to come on GenotypeCast to talk about an issue related to genetics in the news, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.